This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here, KTOL 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And tonight, I have two short stories for you. Well, not too short. But the first one is by Saki, and it's titled The Phantom Luncheon. I'll let you get settled, and I'll be right back with Telling Tales with Ms. G. Stay tuned. And this is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here at KTOO 104.3. Tonight's story by Saki is titled The Phantom Luncheon. The Smithley Dubs are in town, said Sir James. I wish you would show them some attention. Ask them to lunch with you at the Ritz or somewhere. From the little I've seen of the Smithley Dubs, I don't think I want to cultivate their acquaintance, said Lady Drachmaten. They always work for us at election times, said her husband. I don't suppose they influence very many votes. But they have an uncle who is on one of my ward committees, and another uncle speaks sometimes at some of our less important meetings. Those sort of people expect some return in the shape of hospitality. Expect it? Exclaimed Lady Drachmaten. The Mrs. Smithley Dubb do more than that. They almost demand it. They belong to my club and hang about the lobby just about lunchtime, all three of them, with their tongues hanging out of their mouths and the six-course look in their eyes. If I were to breathe the word lunch, they would hustle me into a taxi and scream, Ritz, are doing this to the driver before I knew what was happening. All the same, I think you ought to ask them to a meal of some sort, persisted Sir James. I consider that showing hospitality to the Smithley Dubs is carrying free food principles to a regrettable extreme, said Lady Drachmaten. I've entertained the Joneses and the Browns and the Snapheimers and the Lubrikoffs and heaps of others whose names I forget. But I don't see why I should inflict the society of the Mrs. Smithley Dubb on myself for a solid hour. Imagine it, 60 minutes more or less of unrelenting gobble and gabble. Why can't you take them on, Millie? She asked, turning hopefully to her sister. I don't know them, said Millie hastily. All the better. You can pass yourself off as me. People say that we are so alike that they can hardly tell us apart. And I've only spoken to these tiresome young women about twice in my life at committee rooms and bowed to them in the club. Any of the club page boys will point them out to you. They're always to be found lolling about the hall just before lunchtime. My dear Betty, don't be absurd, protested Millie. I've got some people lunching with me at the Carlton tomorrow, and I'm leaving town the day afterwards. What time is your lunch tomorrow? Asked Lady Drachmaten reflectively. 2 o'clock, said Millie. Good, said her sister. The Smithley Dubs shall lunch with me tomorrow. It shall be rather an amusing lunch party. At least I shall be amused. The last two remarks she made to herself, other people did not always appreciate her ideas of humor. Sir James never did. The next day, Lady Drachmaten made some marked variations in her usual toilet effects. She dressed her hair in an unaccustomed manner and put on a hat that added to the transformation of her appearance. When she had made one or two minor alterations, she was sufficiently unlike her usual smart self to produce some hesitation in the greeting which the Mrs. Smithly Dub bestowed on her in the club lobby. She responded, however, with a readiness which set their doubts at rest. "What is the Carlton like for lunching in?" she asked breezily. The restaurant received an enthusiastic recommendation from the three sisters. "Let's go and lunch there, shall we?" she suggested, and in a few minutes' time the Smithly Dub mind was contemplating at close quarters a happy vista of baked meats and approved vintage. "Are you going to start with caviar?" "I am," confided Lady Rockmorton, and the Smithly Dub started with caviar. The subsequent dishes were chosen in the same ambitious spirit, and by the time they had arrived at the wild duck course, it was beginning to be a rather expensive lunch. The conversation hardly kept pace with the brilliancy of the menu. Repeated references on the part of the guests to the local political conditions and prospects in Sir James's constituency were met with vague ahs and indeeds from Lady Throckmorton, who might have been expected to be specially interested. I think when the Assurance Act is a little better understood, it will lose some of its present unpopularity, hazarded Cecilia Smithy Dub.
Will it?
I dare say. I'm afraid politics don't interest me very much, said Lady Throckmorton. The three Miss Smithly Dubs put down their cups of Turkish coffee and stared. Then they broke into protesting giggles.
Of course you're joking, they said.
Not me, was a disconcerting answer. I can't make head or tail of these bothering old politics. Never could. I never want to. I've quite enough to do to manage my own affairs, and that's a fact.
But, exclaimed Amanda Smithly Dub, with a squeal of bewilderment breaking into her voice,
I was told you spoke so informally about the Insurance Act at one of our social evenings.
It was Lady Throckmorton who stared now.
Do you know, she said, with a scared look around her, rather a dreadful thing is happening? I'm suffering from a complete loss of memory. I can't even think who I am. I remember meeting you somewhere, and I remember you asking me to come and lunch with you here, and that I accepted your kind invitation. Beyond that, my mind is a positive blank.
The scared look was transferred with intensified poignancy to the faces of her companions.
You asked us to lunch, they exclaimed hurriedly. That seemed a more immediately important point to clear up than the question of identity.
Oh, no, said the vanishing hostess. That I do remember about. You insisted on my coming here because the feeding was so good, and I must say it comes up to all you said about it. A very nice lunch it's been. What I'm worrying about is who on earth am I? I haven't the faintest notion.
You are Lady Throckmorton, exclaimed the three sisters in chorus.
Now don't make fun of me, she replied crossly. I happen to know her quite well by sight, and she isn't a bit like me. And it's an odd thing you should have mentioned her, for it so happens she just come into the room.
That lady in black with the yellow plume in her hat, there over by the door.
The Smithly Dubs looked in the indicated direction, and the uneasiness in their eyes deepened into horror. In outward appearance, the lady who had just entered the room certainly came rather nearer to their recollection of their member's wife than the individual who was sitting at table with them.
"Who are you, then, if that is Lady Throckmorton?" they asked in panic-stricken bewilderment.
"That is just what I don't know," was the answer, "and you don't seem to know much better than I do.
You came up to us in the club."
"In what club?"
"The New Didactic in Calais Street."
"The New Didactic?" exclaimed Lady Throckmorton with an air of returning illumination.
"Thank you so much. Of course I remember now who I am. I'm Ellen Neagle, the Ladies' Brash Polishing Guild. The club employs me to come now and then and see to the polishing of the brass fittings. That's how I came to know Lady Throckmorton by sight. She's very often in the club, and you are the ladies who are so kindly asking me out to lunch. Funny how it should all have slipped my memory all of a sudden. The unaccustomed good food and wine must have been too much for me. For the moment, I really couldn't call to mind who I was. Good gracious," she broke off suddenly, "it's 2:10. I should be at a polishing job in Whitehall.
I must scuttle off like a giddy rabbit. Thank you ever so. She left the room with a scuttle sufficiently suggestive of the animal she had mentioned, but the giddiness was all on the side of her involuntary hostesses. The restaurant seemed to be spinning around them, and the bill, when it appeared, did nothing to restore their composure. They were as nearly in tears as it is permissible to be during the luncheon hour in a really good restaurant. Financially speaking, they were well able to afford the luxury of an elaborate lunch, but their ideas on the subject of entertaining differed very sharply, according to the circumstances of whether they were dispensing or receiving hospitality. To have fed themselves liberally at their own expense was perhaps an extravagance to be deplored, but at any rate, they had had something for their money. To have drawn an unknown and socially unremunerative Ellen Niggle into the net of their hospitality was a catastrophe that they could not contemplate with any degree of calmness. The Smithley Dubs never quite recovered from their unnerving experience. They have given up politics and taken to doing good. That was The Phantom Luncheon by Saki. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTOO 104.3 in Juneau, and I'll be right back with another story. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at KTO 104.3. I hope you enjoyed that last story by Saki. I have another one by him. It's called The Secret Sin of Septimus Brope. "Who and what is Mr. Brope?" demanded the aunt of Clovis suddenly. Mrs. Rivers Edge, who had been snipping up the heads of defunct roses and thinking of nothing in particular, sprang hurriedly to mental attention. She was one of those old-fashioned hostesses who consider that one ought to know something about one's guests, and that the something ought to be to their credit. "I believe he comes from Leighton Buzzard," she observed by way of preliminary explanation. "In these days of rapid and convenient travel," said Clovis, who was dispersing a colony of green fly with visitations of cigarette smoke, "to come from Leighton Buzzard does not necessarily denote any great strength of character. It might only mean mere restlessness. Now, if he had left it under a cloud, or as a protest against the incurable and heartless frivolity of its inhabitants, that would tell us something about the man and his mission in life." "What does he do?" pursued Mrs. Troyle, magisterially. "He edits the Cathedral Monthly," said her hostess, "and he's enormously learned about memorial brasses and transepts and the influence of Byzantine worship on modern liturgy, and all those sorts of things. Perhaps he is just a little bit heavy and immersed in one range of subjects, but it takes all sorts to make a good house party, you know. You don't find him too dull, do you?" "Dullness I could overlook," said the aunt of Clovis. "What I cannot forgive is his making love to my maid." "My dear Mrs. Troyle," gasped the hostess, "what an extraordinary idea. I assure you Mr. Brope would not dream of doing such a thing." His dreams are a matter of indifference to me. For all I care, his slumbers may be one long indiscretion of insuitable erotic advances in which the entire servants' hall may be involved. But in his waking hours, he shall not make love to my maid. It's no use arguing about it. I'm firm on the point. But you must be mistaken, persisted Mrs. River's Edge. Mr. Brope would be the last person to do such a thing. He is the first person to do such a thing as far as my information goes, and if I have any voice in the matter, he certainly shall be the last. Of course, I am not referring to respectably intentioned lovers. I simply cannot think that a man who writes so charmingly and informingly about transepts and visiting influence would behave in such an unprincipled manner, said Mrs. River's Edge. What evidence have you that he's doing anything of the sort? I don't want to doubt your word, of course, but we mustn't be too ready to condemn him unheard, must we? Whether we condemn him or not, he has certainly not been unheard. He has the room next to my dressing room, and on two occasions, when I dare say he thought I was absent, I have plainly heard him announcing through the wall, "I love you, Flory." Those partition walls upstairs are very thin. One can almost hear a watch ticking in the next room. Is your maid called Florence? Her name is Florinda. What an extraordinary name to give a maid. I did not give it to her. She arrived in my service already christened. What I mean is, said Mrs. River's Edge, that when I get maids with unsuitable names, I call them Jane. They soon get used to it. An excellent plan, said the aunt of Clovis coldly. Unfortunately, I have got used to being called Jane myself. It happens to be my name. She cut short Mrs. River's Edge's flood of apologies by abruptly remarking, The question is not whether I'm to call my maid Florinda, but whether Mr. Brope is to be permitted to call her Flory. I am strongly of opinion that he shall not. He may have been repeating the words of some song, said Mrs. River's Edge hopefully. There are lots of those sorts of silly refrains with girls' names, she continued, turning to Clovis as a possible authority on the subject. You mustn't call me Mary. I shouldn't think of doing so, Clovis assured her. In the first place, I've always understood that your name is was Henrietta. And then I hardly know you well enough to take such a liberty. I mean, there's a song with that refrain, hurriedly explained Mrs. River's Edge. And there's Rhoda. Rhoda kept a pagoda. And Macy is a daisy. And heaps of others. Certainly it doesn't sound like Mr. Brope to be singing such songs, but I think we ought to give him the benefit of the doubt. I have already done so, said Mrs. Troyle, until further evidence came my way. She shut her lips with the resolute finality of one who enjoys the blessed certainty of being implored to open them again. "Further evidence?" exclaimed her hostess. "Do tell me." As I was coming upstairs after breakfast, Mr. Brope was just passing my room. In the most natural way in the world, a piece of paper dropped out of a packet that he held in his hand and fluttered to the ground just at my door. I was going to call out to him, "You've dropped something," and then for some reason I held back and didn't show myself till he was safely in his room. You see, it occurred to me that I was very seldom in my room just at that hour, and that Florinda was almost always there tidying up things about that time. So I picked up that innocent-looking piece of paper. Mrs. Troyle paused again with the self-applauding air of one who has detected an asp lurking in an apple charlotte. Mrs. River's Edge snipped vigorously at the nearest rose bush, accidentally decapitating a Viscountess of Folkestone that was just coming into broom. "What was on the paper?" she asked. "Just the words in pencil, 'I love you, Flory,' and then underneath, crossed out with a faint line, but perfectly plain to read, 'Meet me in the garden by the yew.'" "There is a yew tree at the bottom of the garden," admitted Mrs. River's Edge. "At any rate, he appears to be truthful," commented Clovis. "To think that a scandal of this sort should be going on under my roof," said Mrs. River's Edge indignantly. "I wonder why is it that scandal seems so much worse under a roof," observed Clovis. "I've always regarded it as a proof of the superior delicacy of the cat tribe that it conducts most of its scandals above the slates. Now I come to think of it, resumed Mrs. River's Edge, there are things about Mr. Brooke that I have never been able to account for. His income, for instance. He only gets $200 a year as editor of the Cathedral Monthly. And I know that his people are quite poor, and he hasn't any private means. Yet he manages to afford a flat somewhere in Westminster, and he goes abroad to Bruges and those sorts of places every year, and always dresses well, and gives quite nice luncheon parties in the season. You can't do all that on $200 a year, can you? Does he write for any other papers? Queried Mrs. Troyle. No. You see, he specializes so entirely on liturgy and ecclesiastical architecture that his field is rather restricted. He once tried the sporting and dramatic with an article on church edifices and famous fox-hunting centers, but it wasn't considered of sufficient general interest to be accepted. No, I don't see how he can support himself in his present style merely by what he writes. Perhaps he sells spurious transepts to American enthusiasts, suggested Clovis. How could you sell a transept? Said Mrs. Riversedge. Such a thing would be impossible. Whatever he may do to eke out his income, interrupted Mrs. Troyle, he is certainly not going to fill in his leisure moments by making love to my maid. Of course not, agreed her hostess. That must be put a stop to at once. But I don't quite know what we ought to do. You might put a barbed wire entanglement round the yew tree as a precautionary measure, said Clovis. I don't think that the disagreeable situation that has arisen is improved by flippancy, said Mrs. River's Edge. A good maid is a treasure. I'm sure I don't know what I should do without Florinda, admitted Mrs. Troyle. She understands my hair. I've long ago given up trying to do anything with it myself. I regard one's hair as I regard husbands. As long as one is seen together in public, one's private divergences don't matter. Surely, that was the luncheon gong. Septimus, Brope, and Clovis had the smoking room to themselves after lunch. The former seemed restless and preoccupied, the latter quietly observant. What is a lorry? Asked Septimus suddenly. I don't mean the thing on wheels. Of course I know what that is. But isn't there a bird with a name like that, the large form of a lorikeet? I fancy it's a lorry with one R, said Clovis lazily, in which case it's no good to you. Septimus Brope stared in some astonishment. How do you mean no good to me? He asked, with more than a trace of uneasiness in his voice. Won't rhyme with flory, explained Clovis briefly. Septimus sat upright in his chair with unmistakable alarm on his face. How did you find out? I mean, how did you know I was trying to get a rhyme to flory? He asked sharply. I didn't know, said Clovis. I only guessed. When you wanted to turn the prosaic lorry of commerce into a feathered poem flitting through the verdure of a tropical forest, I knew you must be working up a sonnet. And flory was the only female name that suggested itself as rhyming with lorry. Septimus still looked uneasy. I believe you know more, he said. Clovis laughed quietly, but said nothing. How much do you know? Septimus asked desperately. The yew tree in the garden, said Clovis. There! I felt certain I dropped it somewhere, but you must have guessed something before. Look here, you have surprised my secret. You won't give me away, will you? It is nothing to be ashamed of, but it wouldn't do for the editor of the Cathedral Monthly to go in openly for that sort of thing. Would it? Well, I suppose not, admitted Clovis. You see, continued Septimus, I get quite a decent lot of money out of it. I could never live in the style I do on what I get as editor of the Cathedral Monthly. Clovis was even more startled than Septimus had been earlier in the conversation, but he was better skilled in repressing surprise. Do you mean to say you get money out of flory? He asked. Not out of flory as yet, said Septimus. In fact, I don't mind saying that I'm having a good deal of trouble over flory, but there are a lot of others. Clovis's cigarette went out. This is very interesting, he said slowly. And then, with Septimus Brope's next words, illumination dawned on him. There are heaps of others. For instance, Cora with the lips of coral. You and I will never quarrel. That was one of my earliest successes, and it still brings me in royalties. And then there is Esmeralda, When I First Beheld Her, and Fair Teresa, How I Love to Please Her. Both of those have been fairly popular. And there is one rather dreadful one, continues Septimus, Flushing Deep Carmine, which has brought me in more money than any of the others. Lively Little Lucy, with her naughty Nez Retrousse. Of course, I loathe the whole lot of them. In fact, I'm rapidly becoming something of a woman-hater under the influence. But I can't afford to disregard the financial aspect of the matter. And at the same time, you can understand that my position as an authority on ecclesiastical, architecture, and liturgical subjects would be weakened, if not altogether ruined, if it once got about that I was the author of Cora with the Lips of Coral and all the rest of them. Clovis had recovered sufficiently to ask in a sympathetic, if rather unsteady, voice, what was the special trouble with Flory? I can't get her into lyric shape, try as I will, Septimus, mournfully. You see, one has to work in a lot of sentimental, sugary compliment with a catchy rhyme and a certain amount of personal biography or prophecy. They've all of them got to have a long string of past successes recorded about them, or else you've got to foretell blissful things about them and yourself in the future. For instance, there is Dainty Little Girly Mavis, She Is Such a Rara Avis, All the Money I Can Save Is All to Be for Mavis Mine. It goes to a sickening namby-pamby waltz tune, and for months nothing else was sung and hummed in Blackpool and other popular centers. This time, Clovis's self-control broke down badly. "Please excuse me," he gurgled, "but I can't help it when I remember the awful solemnity of that article of yours that you so kindly read us last night on the Coptic Church in its relation to early Christian worship," said Timus, groaned. "You see how it would be," he said, "as soon as people knew me to be the author of that miserable sentimental twaddle, all respect for the serious labors of my life would be gone. I dare say I know more about memorial brasses than anyone living. In fact, I hope one day to publish a monograph on the subject. But I should be pointed out everywhere as the man whose ditties were in the mouths of minstrels along the entire coastline of our island home. Can you wonder that I positively hate Flory all the time that I'm trying to grind out sugar-coated rhapsodies about her?" "Why not give free play to your emotions and be beautifully abusive? An uncomplimentary refrain would have an instant success as a novelty if you were sufficiently outspoken." "I've never thought of that," said Septimus, "and I'm afraid I couldn't break away from the habit of fulsome adulation and suddenly change my style." "You didn't change your style in the least," said Clovis. "Merely reverse the sentiment and keep to the inane phraseology of the thing. If you'll do the body of the song, I'll knock off the refrain, which is the thing that principally matters, I believe. I shall charge half shares in the royalties and throw in my silences to your guilty secret. In the eyes of the world, you shall still be the man who has devoted his life to the study of transepts and Byzantine ritual. Only sometimes, in the long winter evenings, when the wind howls drearily down the chimney and the rain beats against the windows, I shall think of you as the author of Cora with the Lips of Coral. Of course, if in sheer gratitude at my silence you would like to take me for a much-needed holiday to the Adriatic, or somewhere equally interesting, paying all expenses, I shouldn't dream of refusing." Later in the afternoon, Clovis found his aunt in Mrs. Riversedge indulging in gentle exercise in the Jacobean garden. "I've spoken to Mr. Brope about F," he announced. "How splendid of you! What did he say?" came in a quick chorus from the two ladies. "He was quite frank and straightforward with me when he saw that I knew his secret," said Clovis, "and it seems that his intentions were quite serious, if slightly unsuitable. I tried to show him the impracticality of the course that he was following. He said he wanted to be understood, and he seemed to think that Florinda would excel in that requirement, but I pointed out that there were probably dozens of delicately nurtured, pure-hearted young English girls who would be capable of understanding him, while Florinda was the only person in the world who understood my aunt's hair. That rather weighed with him, for he's not really a selfish animal, if you take him in the right way. And when I appealed to the memory of his happy childish days, spent amid the daisied fields of Leighton Buzzard, I suppose daisies do grow there, he was obviously affected. Anyhow, he gave me his word that he would put Florinda absolutely out of his mind, and he has agreed to go for a short trip abroad as the best distraction for his thoughts. I'm going with him as far as Ragusa. If my aunt should wish to give me a really nice scarf pin to be chosen by myself, as a small recognition of the very considerable service I had done her, I shouldn't dream of refusing. I'm not one of those who think that because one is abroad, one can go about dressed anyhow. A few weeks later, in Blackpool and lit places where they sing, the following refrain held undisputed sway. How you bore me, Florrie, with those eyes of bacon blue. You'll be very sorry, Florrie, if I marry you. Though I'm easy going, Florrie, this I swear is true. I'll throw you down a quarry, Florrie, if I marry you. That was The Secret Sin of Septimus Brope by Saki. It's been Telling Tales with Ms. G. Until next time, good night.